is January 27th, 1973. It's a day that I remember very, very well. Our church, the Denver Citadel Corps, C-O-R-P-S, where my dad was one of the lay leaders of the church, had gathered at Camp Elephant Rock, which is just outside Palmer Lake, Colorado. You can Google it. It's still there. Where every January the church would gather for a weekend. We basically pick the whole church up, go up to the camp, and have all of our Sunday services there and spend Saturday and Friday night and Saturday kind of in a breakout session and prayer warrior sessions. And you know how church retreats go. That's what it was. This particular one, however, was marked by a very unique event. As we all arrived on Friday afternoon and evening, the storm clouds were building over the front range there of the Rockies, and overnight it dumped somewhere in the area of, now again, I was nine. I know it was deep. I'm guessing somewhere between 6 and 8 feet of snow fell on the camp that night. It was fantastic. I mean, for a bunch of us 9-year-old kids, 10-year-old kids, this was absolutely the best thing that could possibly have happened. And we had a blast digging tunnels through the snow. It's the first time I ever remember digging tunnels in snow and sliding down hills and just having a ball. I remember Saturday the 27th, after all the snow had dropped overnight, being just a brilliantly sunny day. It was cold, but it was one of the most beautiful days I remember in my entire life. And maybe it was just having so much fun with my friends and being at camp. I don't know. It was a fantastic day. What I remember was we didn't really want to come in because we were having fun, but we were there for other purposes, and so we had to go to certain things and certain events and certain happenings, one of which was the, I don't know what it was called, but it was right before dinner, or maybe right after dinner, I don't remember. I remember the sun being up, so it had to be before dinner because it was January, and kind of a pre-dinner devotional kind of thing. And my father, who was one of the lay leaders of the church, the Corps, C-O-R-P-S, was leading the devotional that evening. And I remember his voice. I remember seeing him stand up front. This to me is as clear as dropping my son off at school this morning for a pre-school starting convention of some sort that I did about an hour ago. My father in those days was very tall. He was 4F. He could not join the military because of a bout of hepatitis as a young man, which is in itself an interesting story that maybe someday we'll get into. But my father, who was, as I describe him, a very Eisenhowerian Republican, raised by my grandfather, who was very much a hardline Republican, stood up front and announced to everyone there, because again, we were basically out of contact with everything, but he announced to everyone there that on January 27th, that day, the Paris Peace Accords had been signed by the United States and Vietnam. And that insofar as America was concerned, the Vietnam War was over. Now, we weren't naive. We knew that the war itself would still go on, but we would no longer be involved. No longer would American mothers and fathers and parents and brothers and sisters and fathers and husbands and wives be informed that their loved ones had been killed in the jungles of Southeast Asia. And I remember the relief in that room was palpable. There were tears. There was smiles. There was joy. There was thanksgiving. There was, of course, a spontaneous outbreak of praise and songs and prayers and the likes of that, none of which at 9 years old had a whole lot of interest to me. I guess in the back of my mind, maybe I said to myself, well, at least I won't go to Vietnam now. But I was 9. I wasn't really all that worried about it anyway. I remember that to this day. It's one of the clearest memories I have of my childhood because it was so impactful and it was such an involved day. In the post-Vietnam experience, we watched as our troops came home over the years, and their welcome home is well remembered by us as not being particularly good. There was no parade. There was no returning victor. There was none of that nonsense. There was none of this stuff about, oh, you did a great job. Congratulations. There was no welcome dinner at the American Legion. In fact, to some degree, the American Legion's the veterans organizations that were at that time populated by World War II people who were, for the most part, in their 50s and 60s at that point, late 50s, 60s, maybe their 70s, really controlled those veterans organizations. They were not welcoming as they should have been to the veterans who were returning from Vietnam. And we've documented all, we've talked about all this. And of course, there was the famous spitting on the troops, calling them baby killers, whatever. The troops themselves, in some cases, were not behaving much better. I mean, we could talk about the veterans against Vietnam throwing their medals over the White House fence. We could spend hours talking about John Kerry, who served in Vietnam, and his quote-unquote testimony, unquote, to the United States Senate. Some of the troops weren't behaving much better, but as a general rule, most of them were. But there had been a lot of damage done to these men. It's the squeaky wheel that gets the grease, though. And so all of the attention went to the minority of troops who were behaving poorly rather than the vast majority who were not. It's intriguing to me because I look back at that time as the time where my own interest in serving in the military began to grow. Maybe not at 9, but certainly by 12. I was becoming very interested in it. The odd thing to me is looking back is that most of my interest in the military, though, was not based on modern times, as it were. Most of my interest in the military was based on World War II and the heroes, the technology, the service of World War II. In 1976, my family took another Salvation Army church trip to Los Angeles, California. First time I'd ever seen the Pacific Ocean. And we found ourselves, for some reason, I don't remember why, in San Diego. We drove down to San Diego. And there at North Island, we were on a beach somewhere and kind of looking across the way there, and there was a United States aircraft carrier. And it happened to be, I took a picture of it. Still have the picture in one of my albums somewhere. CV-64 USS Constellation. It's the first modern warship, I guess, that I'd ever seen in my life. And I was instantaneously enthralled and hooked, and you know the rest of the story from there. Still, my passion for the military didn't come out of the Vietnam era other than the technology of it, the Constellation, the B-52s my grandfather worked on. It's kind of weird to me to look back at that now and think about those things. In my own service, in the post-Gulf War I, the post-Cold War experience, it was much different than Vietnam. And I think there's still a lot of resentment about that. And there should be. The way that the Gulf War ended with the parade down Virginia Beach Boulevard and at Mount Trashmore, these ticker tape parades that were held around the country, people greeting returning troops like they had just won the Super Bowl or something, you know, meeting them at the airport, the overemphasis on troops and service. I've said this before as a veteran of the Cold War and the first Gulf War. I'm always a little, I don't mind it. I don't object to it. I'm not going to say, I would never say to somebody, please don't do that. but I'm uncomfortable with the constant thank you for your service thing. I didn't do it for your thanks sort of thing. And I know other veterans have expressed that at the same time, but in so many ways, I think it's an overreaction to our national reaction to the returning of the Vietnam veterans. We want to make sure that never happens again. And so we go beyond that. Then you get the things like, I support the troops, but not the war. I don't know. It was a much different reaction when the Cold War ended and when the first Gulf War ended than it was at Vietnam, obviously. Now, maybe national purpose was different. Maybe we had a clearer goal. You know, we're going to eject Iraq from Kuwait. And we did that. Who knows? Today, the war ended, and all we got was a simple tweet from the AP. It seemed odd to me. It really did. The AP sent out that tweet about the last U.S. transport plane has left Afghanistan. America's 20-year war in Afghanistan is over. More to follow. It sort of left me feeling, I'm not even sure. I've tried to analyze my own feelings about that tweet. I knew the, obviously we knew everything was ending. We knew the withdrawal was coming. We knew the deadline was going to be today. We knew all that. But somehow that short tweet announcing it seemed to capture a lot more than it does just looking at the electrons glowing on my screen. How much the world has changed since 1973. How much difference there is, and yet how much is the same? How do we feel about this? Where we're not welcoming home troops the way we did in Vietnam. We watched as President Biden and Mrs. Biden went and greeted the dignified transfer of the remains of those killed in the most recent attack. That never happened in Vietnam. Even if a president did go to Dover to greet the returning deceased troops, it was done under the cover of darkness. It was done quietly. There was no fanfare to it. It certainly wasn't a photo op, which I got to be honest with you, that's how I kind of felt watching it. I get the dignity of it. I get the importance of it. But to me, I don't know. I got to be honest with you. If that had been me on that plane, I'd really rather not have the president there. I don't need the president there. I don't need that. This should have been a very, to me, closed time. But that's my opinion. How do we fail? How do we feel? Who failed us? That's the question I find myself wandering this morning. Who failed us in all of this? Was it Biden? I read this morning that the reason that he went ahead with the August 31st pullout was because there's a belief that the Taliban would not have helped with diplomatic evacuations after the 31st, and that by meeting our side of the agreement, they'll keep their side of the agreement, and they will continue to help evacuate the people that were left behind. That's followed with we don't really trust the Taliban. We don't really believe that they'll keep their word, but at least now we have the moral high ground, I guess. Did Biden fail us? I know you don't want to hear this. Did Donald Trump fail us? In a way, I mean, this could have been done 4 years ago, right? With pretty much the same effect. Maybe under Trump it would have been more organized. Maybe under Trump it would have been handled better. But the traditional kick the can down to the road to the next guy went on, and maybe Trump faced resistance in the military because the military-industrial complex clearly did not want to pull out of Afghanistan. Why would they? Did Trump fail us? Did Obama fail us? He ran his entire campaign on ending these wars. He ran his entire campaign in 2008 was, we're going to get out of this war. Going to close Gitmo. That's the first thing he did. First half hour he was in the White House, he's signing executive orders to close these things, and never happened. Still hasn't happened. Did Obama fail us? Did George Bush fail us? We went in on his watch. As far as Afghanistan was concerned, we went in to get bin Laden. Did Bush fail us? I think the argument is that there's enough blame to spread around that we'll spend the next, I don't know, 20 years writing books and newspaper articles and retrospectives about whose fault is this? And depending on your politics, you'll pick your villain, and that's pretty much what it'll be. And the answer, the truth is, it's all of them. It's all of them, and it's all of us. We didn't hold any of them accountable. We didn't hold Congress accountable. We didn't hold anybody accountable for this. It's our fault. But we'll feel better by blaming someone of the other stripe, the other political side. If you're a Democrat, you'll blame Trump and Bush. And if you're a Republican, you'll blame Obama and Biden. Will you ever stop to think about any of the other things? Probably not. What happens tomorrow? Will those who want to get out, get out? Will the Taliban actually cooperate with us? My gut is no, but the administration clearly hopes that that will happen. And of course, when you're reduced to hopes for what will happen, they usually don't come to pass, do they? What happens when there's another attack on the United States, another 911 type of attack? And folks, I'm just going to tell you, it's going to happen again. It's going to happen again. So you might as well get used to the idea that it's going to happen again. Where? When? I don't know. But what happens when it's clear that the people who pull that attack off are Taliban-supported or Taliban-protected like bin Laden was? What happens in the geopolitical situation? We have nations right now that are heavily dependent upon the United States keeping its word and keeping its protections in place. South Korea is a great example. Now, South Korea is a prospering democracy, economy, and it has a very strong military. I think that the South Korean military would fight to tooth and nail to the death against the North Korean invasion, but I mean you're facing off against an army that literally has nothing to lose. How hard will that be? And what will the United States' response be if North Korea, which today started up a reactor in its nuclear weapons program again? What will our response be? What happens if Communist China decides to invade the Republic of China, Taiwan, which has been utterly dependent on the United States for its protection since 1949? Does Taiwan today believe that the United States will meet those obligations, treaty obligations? What about Israel? I worry about Israel a lot. But I also don't worry about them a lot either, because I know that there's contingency. I'm sure that there is contingency. I don't know this because I don't sit in their cabinet meetings, but I'm pretty sure there's contingency plans for what happens if the United States reneges on its support of Israel. Today, tomorrow, the youngest veterans from Vietnam, the men who were 18 years old in 1973 when they left Vietnam for the last time, they're now in their late 60s. The older ones, well beyond that. World War II and Korean vets are almost gone. There's so few left, and they're passing at an unbelievable rate. The World War II Korean vets, like I said, are gone. Even the Gulf War I veterans, myself, Korean War veterans, or not Korean War, Cold War veterans, the youngest of them are now in their late 40s. Most of them are like me. They're in their closing in on their 60s or 70s. What lessons can we learn from them? I'll tell you the lessons I take. There's two of them. Number one is that the military mission will go on. The mission is to keep the peace. Now, maybe you disagree with how it's doing it. Maybe you don't like how it's doing it. But that's the mission, keep the peace. Even today, ships, airplanes, tanks, troops are practicing today. My buddy Alex is out at sea today trying to train. Well, they aren't trying. They are training to keep the peace, to do every job it takes to keep the peace. And there are a lot of jobs that we don't even think about. Somebody's got to cook the food. Somebody has to keep the screw turning. Someone has to clean the toilets. All of that is part of the mission of keeping the peace. I know it sounds weird, but it's true. And they're doing it today. But I think the lesson that I take from all this, more than anything, as we morosely watch what's happening and we point fingers at the other side and we all blame each other and we all yell at each other, whose fault is this? This is your fault. And we get on Twitter and we, you know, in 140 characters, eviscerate our opponents and blah, 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 blah. You know what the lesson I take from all this is? In 40 years, this will all be forgotten. Oh, no, Dave. No, it won't. You know, it's weird to me because my war ended 40 years ago, and not only do we not talk about it anymore, it's like the other side won. With as many people in this country are embracing communism, it's almost like I'm asking myself, why do we bother? We're just going to be communist anyway. In 40 years, this will all be forgotten, just like every other conflict that the United States has had. Oh, we know about the American Revolution and the Civil War, World War I and World War II. How many other conflicts have we had that nobody pays any attention to at all? None. Including the one we actually call the Forgotten War. There are a lot more. There were a lot more times we asked our troops to serve for us, and we forgot about it. And I just got a feeling that in 20 years, 40 years, Afghanistan's going to be the same way. We're just going to shelve it somewhere back there where, you know, military historians and scholars can study it. But everybody else is just going to move on. And nobody will remember that it ended with a tweet.